living some little men and women. They are our past. And maybe, maybe they are our future.
Good afternoon. You're listening to KPFZ 88.1, Lakeport, Clear Lake, and all of Lake County. Good afternoon again. It's Tyra St. John with Inside Out, and this series is DNA of Carl Jung. We have again with us today Reverend Robert Henderson. How are you today?
Very good. We're having very nice kind of late summer weather here in Connecticut.
Right. Well, Rob, you have written two remarkable books that have to do with your interviews with Jungian analysts. And I got to speak with you once before. You've been on the air, and I wanted to have you back to fill out some of the questions that we didn't get to answer before.
Mm-hmm.
And it's nice to hear from you again.
Well, thank you. It's nice to hear your voice also.
Thank you so much. You and your wife edited these books together largely in the beginning, and now you're doing more of it yourself, and she is giving you a lot of assistance. And her name is Janice Henderson.
That's right. Her name is Janice.
And you're bringing out another book in, is it with December?
Yes. Another book is will be going to the publishers within a month and should be out at the end of the year or the first of next year.
Wow, you're pretty prolific.
Yes, it keeps coming along. We're doing a lot of the interviews.
Right. That will be your third volume.
That'll be the third volume.
And this one has 18 interviews in it?
This will have either 17 or 18 interviews in.
Wow.
The first two have each had 12.
Right. Are they longer? Are they shorter? Are they the same?
Well, they're about the same.
Right.
Yeah.
What was your purpose initially in writing these books? How did you get involved there?
Well, it really started back in 1991, where I had spent most of my professional career involved in Jungian psychology, both as a practicing therapist and also in the kind of schooling that I've had. And I was curious as to whether or not, see, I knew there were people that were still alive around the world that actually knew Jung and had worked with Jung. And I was curious as to whether they would sit down and talk with me about their impressions of who he was. So that's where it got started. And I was, in 1992, I happened to be going to Zurich to study at the Jung Institute in Zurich. So before I left, I had written a letter to Adolf Guggenbuehl Greig, who was a very prominent Jungian analyst in Zurich, and I asked him whether or not I could interview him. My delight, he sent back a very nice letter saying, yes, he'd be very willing to sit down when I came over to Zurich, and so that became the first interview. Since then, it has gone on from there. One interview has led to another, and I would say at this point, they've become pretty popular, and sometimes even people call me up to do the interviews. It's just kind of caught on in some way, so that's really kind of nice.
So Adolf Guggenbuehl Greig, is he still living now?
No, he's not. He passed away last year.
Mm. So that's a very valuable interview that you have.
Yeah.
He knew Carl Jung?
Yep. From there, I interviewed Janice and I interviewed several people who actually worked with Jung. All those people have now passed away. So I'm really glad that we were able to get those interviews, you know, in time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm so glad, too.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to reading all of them. I've read some of them in Volumes 1 and 2.
Uh-huh.
Of course, I haven't seen Volume 3.
Yeah.
And I have much more to read also in the first two.
You know, they're the kind of books, I think that maybe you have found this yourself. You probably aren't going to sit down and read the whole book, you know. But because there are 12 interviews in each of the first two volumes, you can kind of read an interview and then just put it aside. You know, there's a lot of substance in the interviews. I mean, they're not just sort of an easy read. But
right.
There's a lot of substance. And the idea is that it offers another way to understand Jungian psychology through the lives of people that have actually lived it most of their life. You know, so a lot of the people in there, I'd say probably the youngest person that I've interviewed has been maybe in their early 50s, and even at that point has spent a tremendous amount of time and energy, both with their own personal work and their own professional work, you know, with Jungian psychology. So it's another way, I would say, starting to try to understand what Jung was all about, but also people that have been in the field a long time, to get kind of another sense of Jungian psychology by listening through the writings to people that have really wrestled with all the various parts of Jungian psychology. Right. That's kind of one of the purposes, I think, of the interviews.
So do you see in their lives, when you're interviewing them, the results of their study of Carl Jung?
Yeah, to ask somebody how they, for example, deal with their dreams. What are their own personal ways of dealing with their dreams?
Right.
And so as you hear people talk about that, you get a sense of what dreams mean to them, but also how they come through the years to work with dreams, or through the concept of the shadow. How's the shadow in their lives? How have they found the shadow in their marriages or their families or their relationships in some way? The way to really get a feeling for Jungian psychology through the lives of very seasoned, experienced, and reflective people.
Right. Sounds terrific. And I also agree with you in reading some of the interviews that you had. I want to tell our listeners the names of the books, which are,
okay,
they're all Living with Jung, J-U-N-G. That's Carl Jung we're talking about. And it's Interviews with Jungian Analysts. And we said in our last interview that you spelled interviews with an E. It was a more interpersonal and inside entree into their psyches.
Yes.
Does that say it?
That's true. In fact, in Volume 1 in the introduction, we have a little bit in there about why the word interviews is used instead of interviews.
Right.
So that's kind of an interesting thing.
And I started spelling everything that begins with I-N-T-E-R with an E-N-T-E-R. I've gotten all... it's just confused my spelling. It's very funny.
Yes.
But I like it, and I understand your point with that.
Yeah, good.
And you've had very, very outstanding people do the introductions and prefaces, I mean, the forewords and that sort of thing.
Yes.
With your books, including Dr. John Beebe.
But I have interviewed Thomas More for some other publications, but he's not actually in any of the books. The people in the books are actually Jungian analysts.
They're certified Jungian
analysts. Yeah, they're certified Jungian analysts, right.
And you yourself are a therapist, and you're a pastoral therapist.
That's right. I'm an ordained minister in the United Church of Christ. My title is I have a doctorate degree in pastoral psychotherapy, and I refer to myself as a Jungian pastoral psychotherapist.
I find it so interesting as a deeply spiritual person to rectify, I guess you'd call it, or to balance that of how we perceive, I guess you'd call it, evil in the world from a Jungian perspective,
mm-hmm,
and how we might perceive it differently as been taught in traditional Christianity,
mm-hmm,
in a sense. Do you have any thoughts about any of that? Do you ever cross your mind?
I think you take the various parts of theology and various parts of biblical traditions. I think if you look at it through the sort of the lens of Jungian psychology, you get a whole other sort of way of understanding it. So, for example, the whole concept of evil, which goes back to the beginning of time, is a very important part of life. But to understand it through the notion of the shadow through Jungian psychology, I think it offers a kind of a psychologically sophisticated way and a deeper way of understanding and making very real what evil actually is, or what we perceive to be evil to be. So that's why I find Jungian psychology very helpful in my life as a spiritual person. It sort of grounds me. When I have a psychological grounding of spirituality, I'm a little bit more balanced. I'm a little bit more in touch with life than if I didn't have that grounding.
Right. It's more like also being in touch with your soul.
That's mm-hmm. right.
The concept of life in Christianity, of course, is one life. In other religions, some of them it has something, you know, something that relates to maybe reincarnation or past lives.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, it's in Christianity as well, in the Old Testament and even in the New Testament, where Jesus is, you know, like, who are you? Where were you? What were your former lives? And that kind
mm-hmm.
of thing. And how do you justify that in terms, or how do you talk about that or understand it in terms of Jungian psychology and from a Jungian psychology point of view also? You know, that we might have had a number of lives where we develop certain kinds of habits or shadows or hurts or, you know, things that happen to us, injuries that would cause us to be harsh or hard or cold. Or how do you make that out to be real?
Yeah, well, I guess one of the ways I make it out is in the understanding of the unconscious.
Right.
And oftentimes religions may not really deal with the unconscious or include the unconscious, so things become, I would say, for some religions or for some people that how they understand their religion, it tends to be not as deep mm-hmm. and perhaps a little shallow. But when you bring the whole concept of the unconscious into religion and you have a notion, for example, that nothing is ever lost, so that things change and death becomes a transformation process, that we go from sort of one way of living to another way of living.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, you know, the whole notion that things sort of live on and there's a sense of eternity about life. I think the old notion of past lives is sort of wrapped up in that a little bit. I know we could probably spend a lot more time on that.
Right.
I think when you include the unconscious, religion takes an expanse that frequently is not there in a way a lot of people understand religion.
Right.
And Jungian psychology really helps that.
It's funny because when I started studying religion, I thought there was when I started studying psychology, I thought there was a compromise in some way with some of my religious beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
But as I've read and read and studied, it has deepened my spiritual belief.
Isn't that wonderful? I found the same thing. Yeah.
Right.
And that's where particularly Jung, because he thought religion and spirituality were so central to a person's life, that it was just something that you eventually had to understand. He said that eventually everybody, you know, has to come to terms with their spirituality. That may take them into their midlife or, you know, their 40s and 50s, but eventually the spiritual questions become the questions of life.
Right. You started out at Andover Newton, or what school was that in?
Where I got my doctorate from was Andover Newton Theological School in Boston.
And how did that interface with your ultimate move in the Jungian direction?
When I graduated from seminary in Ohio, I grew up in Ohio. When I graduated from seminary, I got married. After Janice and I got married, we moved to Boston, and I started the program at Andover Newton Theological School, somewhat innocent of what I was really getting into. And once I arrived on campus, I discovered that the chairman of our department is actually a close personal friend of Carl Jung. And up to that point, I don't even know if I knew how to say the word Jung in the correct way. I probably said Jung, like a lot of people
right. Still
do. So that was just a fortuitous kind of experience to meet this person. So my doctorate degree was really, in many ways, a doctorate degree in Jungian psychology. I mean, it was just the impact, you know, who was the head of the department that prevailed throughout the whole coursework and everything. And that led eventually going to Zurich a couple of times to study, and led to my own personal analysis with three different Jungian analysts and a lot of workshops and meeting a lot of people. And it just kind of exploded and provided me really with the grounding for me to do what I've been doing for the last 40 years in pastoral psychotherapy here in Connecticut.
Was your teacher at the Andover, or the man that you knew that was your mentor, was he a Jungian analyst?
No, he wasn't. He was actually an ordained minister.
Right.
And he was a professor of pastoral psychotherapy. He was not a Jungian analyst, no.
Is he still alive?
No, he's passed on. His name was Dr. John Belinsky.
He sounds like a jewel.
He really was.
Do you know your personality type?
I tend to be extroverted thinker. I would say that's my primary type.
Okay.
But as I've gotten older, as I think we all change and go through various transformations and everything, I think my introverted side and my feeling side are getting to be a lot stronger than ever, particularly my introverted side.
Okay. They say men don't really reach their full complement of spirituality until sort of late in life or later in life.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's because they're very much tied up sort of biologically in taking care of their families when they're young.
Mm-hmm.
And going out and getting the meat and potatoes and taking those steps that men have done traditionally throughout history.
Uh-huh.
And then when that, you know, lets up a little bit, and maybe their children start taking care of them or whatever, they are able to ponder more and think about life.
That's a good way to say it. And I would actually say the same is true of women.
Okay. Well, I'm not surprised at that.
that women are all sort of involved with raising children and these days having their careers and everything. And once life starts to slow down a little bit, I think that pondering experience sets in with many women also.
Right. I was hoping to interview your wife, Janice, since she's one of the co-authors of your books.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that she is very instrumental in your discussions.
One of the things we found is that, you know, I've done some of the interviews by myself, but we found that every time, particularly with men, every time she was present, there was just a sense that it went a lot easier, much more spontaneous. I think a lot of men felt a lot more comfortable having Janice there, and she added just a nice touch. She's very introverted, and so she and I are opposites in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a nice balance when we did the interviews.
I think a lot of people are attracted to their opposites to fill those parts of ourselves that, that aren't there sort of naturally.
Exactly, and that's one of the wonderful things of life, and it's also one of the nightmares of life, I think.
Right, of course.
Yeah.
But we sort of morph into the other personality,
yes,
in a sense. You know, it's just like having a dog or a cat.
Yes, that's true.
I used to laugh in New York City because people would walk down the street and their pets all looked like them. You know, in the face. And I wondered if we do that, you know, as couples, that we just look more and more like each other as we go.
Yeah, that's good.
That's funny, isn't it?
When I go to New York the next time, I'll take a closer look at that.
Right. It's just kind of amusing.
Yeah.
Who were some of the memorable analysts that you've interviewed in, say, Volume 1?
Well, I think Janice and I both agreed that one of our favorites in Volume 1 was Jane and Joe Wheelwright.
Mm-hmm.
Jane and Joe Wheelwright were 89 years old when we interviewed them. They were the second interview.
Mm-hmm.
How it came about was kind of an interesting story in that I had done the first interview with Adolf in Zurich, and that interview had gotten published in a Jungian journal in Los Angeles, Psychological Perspectives. So I thought, well, if we can have one of these, maybe we can have another one. Janice and I had actually attended a workshop that Jane and Joe Wheelwright had done here in Connecticut several years prior. And so, you know, we had some sense. I mean, we actually liked when they did this workshop. So I thought, well, I don't even know if these people are still alive, but I do know they're in the San Francisco area. So I sat down one night and I wrote a letter. This is before email and computers and everything. And I wrote a letter to him and just asked him if we might be able to do an interview.
Mm-hmm.
And I sent it to the Jung Institute in San Francisco thinking that either they were connected there or those people could forward the letter on to somebody,
mm-hmm,
or to the Wheelwrights. So I would say in about 3 or 4 months, I got this letter back from the Wheelwrights. And at this point, they were both well into retirement, living on this huge ranch that they owned outside of Santa Barbara. And they said they were just living their retirement and really weren't doing anything public anymore. And like I say, they were in their late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
But they said that they had read the letter I wrote to them, and they had lived with it a little while. And it touched something in them that they said, we would like to invite you both out to our ranch for a weekend.
Mm.
This is going to be the last thing we do publicly in our lives. So we would like you to come out, if you'd like to, and we'll spend a weekend together.
Mm.
Well, that was just a thrill. Oh, my golly. So Janice and I took off and went to Santa Barbara. We just had a weekend that we will always remember with Jane and Joe Wheelwright. We spent the whole weekend with them, and we taped everything that we talked about. We even videotaped it. I have some videotapes of the whole thing.
Mm.
And these were just the most delightful people that we had ever imagined. Just totally open and honest and forthcoming in every way possible. It was something just being with them in a living situation as opposed to meeting them in an office or something.
Right.
But they were just totally delightful. So that led us to eventually transcribing everything that was done, and that interview got published. They're both passed away now. But it was just a memory that was just amazing. Jane and Joe Wheelwright, if you don't know who they are, they were the ones, they sort of were instrumental in bringing Jungian psychology from Europe to the United States.
Mm.
So they were very key people in the whole growth of Jungian psychology in our country.
Are they U.S. citizens or are they Americans?
They were U.S. citizens, that's right. And they were very prominent. They've been very prominent in the San Francisco area.
And they were part of the Jungian Institute, probably.
They were one of the founders of the Jungian Institute.
And in San Francisco.
In San Francisco, right.
They were both analysts.
They were both analysts.
Who had studied under Jung himself.
They were.
Mm.
Yes.
What was Jane like?
Jane was deaf when we interviewed her. She was just a very delightful person. Wonderful mind about her. Very well spoken. She was deaf, so it was hard for her to hear.
Mm-hmm.
And Joe was blind.
Oh, my gracious.
So they somehow managed with these handicaps to still live a very, very active and productive life.
Mm.
I would say Jane was introverted as Joe was extroverted. Joe was just a raging extrovert.
Mm-hmm.
And Jane was just as introverted as Joe was. They had a real balance, and they had been married, I think, something like 65 years when we met them.
Mm.
They talked a lot in the interview, Volume 1, about their marriage. And that's a delightful thing to read about all the ways they've kind of hung in there with their marriage and had their battles. And
right.
To read that interview is to learn a lot about how Jungian psychology can help a marriage, I would say.
That's great to know.
Yeah.
So she couldn't hear, and he couldn't see.
Yes.
Quite a thing to live with, especially when you're 89.
Oh, my golly. It was. Mm-hmm. It was.
Were they both therapists before they became Jungian analysts?
Joe was a psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm.
Being Jungian analyst was, I think, their entree into being therapist.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Hmm.
That interview, I've gotten a lot of feedback. That tends to be a popular one that people like in Volume 1.
If I'm ever in Connecticut, you have time, I'd love to see those videotapes.
Yes, I'd be very happy to show those to you.
That would be wonderful. And I want to tell our listeners that you are listening to Robert Henderson, who is a co-author of Interviews with Jungian Analysts. It's called Living with Jung. He's written Volume 1, and that's been published. He's written Volume 2, and that's been published. And now Volume 3 is, I think it's actually been mailed to the publisher, hasn't it? Almost.
Probably about in a week or so.
So it'll be out in December. That'll be a much thicker book even than this one. And these are several hundred pages. And the new one, more like 300 or 350 pages.
It could be. We haven't nailed that down yet. Yeah.
Okay, so it'd be a fairly sizable book.
Yeah.
And I bought mine on Amazon. They're available throughout the world.
They are available on Amazon and Borders and Barnes & Noble and several places on the Internet.
Right. So you mentioned Robert Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
I think, was he in Volume 1?
He was in Volume 2.
Volume 2.
Yeah, and he was in Volume 2.
He's one of my heroes that I studied when I was at Pacifica Graduate Institute and still read his books. I think I ordered 3 or 4 of them. He has so many.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've ordered 3 or 4 just recently.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you remember most about your interview with him?
Well, I interviewed, Janice wasn't with me on that interview, but I interviewed him in his apartment in San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
He was 70 years old. I think he may be 80 years old now. He's still alive. It was interesting to visit where he lived, like you were. I had read all his books. He's, in fact, the most published Jungian writer, I think, at least in America.
Mm-hmm.
As you said, he's got a number of wonderful books out. In fact, there's two new books I've been reading. One's called Inner Gold. It just came out on the whole notion of projection.
Okay.
And another one is Living Your Unlived Life, which right. is a fascinating book, and those just came out within the last 6 months or so, I think. But anyways, one of the things I remember about him, he showed me a harpsichord that he had built in his apartment that was working, and he also showed me a pot that's growing, and it has only four-leaf clovers in it.
Oh, my word.
And he has a tradition that when he sends you a letter, he attaches four-leaf clover at the bottom of it.
Oh, how wonderful.
And so after the interview was over with, I got this wonderful letter that I framed in my office, and it has this wonderful four-leaf clover.
Oh, that's so remarkable. Oh,
yeah.
What a lovely idea to do.
Yeah, it really was. But I just remember him as a very thoughtful, it's one of my favorite interviews, really. I think it, particularly if you not only like Robert Johnson, but if you tend to be introverted,
mm-hmm.
I think you'll learn a lot about, well, extroverts will learn a lot about introverts by reading it also, but he writes a lot about himself as a solitary person and as an introvert.
Okay.
And it has a lot of richness in what he says. I love the interview with him.
He's almost poetic.
He is.
In the way he thinks. And his books are small, so
yes.
They're not overwhelming, really.
They're not overwhelming, that's right. And they're very readable.
Very cogent, all of them.
Yes.
Did he write something about the inner life? I'm trying to think if that was somebody else.
He wrote one of the more popular ones. It's called Inner Work.
Inner Work, that was the one I was thinking. Right.
Yes, I think he told me that's his most popular book.
Right.
But He and She and We are also very nice books that he wrote.
Tiny books.
Tiny books, mm-hmm. That's right.
I think he's pretty remarkable.
He is.
Do you usually read all the books and articles that you can?
I try to. Sometimes, unless the people have books that I can get a hold of, I try to read the articles or where I can get them. I do try to read those, yes. Actually, a lot of the people I've already read most books.
Pretty daunting.
It is.
I respect that very much in you. I try to do that, too. I have a pile probably 2 feet high beside my bed, and then I've got shelves all over my house.
I'll bet it's an interesting house, and I'll bet you got a lot of nice books.
I had yours, I had your volume one
uh-huh.
that I'd had for a long, long time,
uh-huh.
and I searched everywhere for it. I must have let somebody borrow it or something, but I couldn't find it. So
yes.
I got another one, and then I got volume two, and I'm looking forward to volume three.
Yes, well.
So.
There comes the right time to read, right?
And it's so fulfilling to read this kind of material.
Yeah.
Do you always meet the person in person, or do you sometimes do it by
phone? No, I don't. I've gotten into, sometimes I'll do some of the interviews on the internet, and then I'll have a chance to actually, you know, visit them somewhere where they're living. Some of the ones in Volume 3, I made a trip about a year ago to Paris, and I interviewed a couple people over in Paris, and then I stopped in Zurich and spent some time in Switzerland, and I interviewed 3 people in Switzerland.
Mm.
All those interviews were started on the internet.
Who was the person you interviewed in Paris?
Mm-hmm. Well, there were 2 people. One was a woman named Vivienne Theodore, and another one was Christian Gilliard. They're both very prominent Jungian analysts in Paris.
Is that Christian or Kristen?
Christian.
Christian.
Yes.
And what's his last name?
Gilliard.
Were you able to get his books in English?
No, I really couldn't. I didn't find anything. I couldn't get anything that he had written. So I just had to, once I got started on the interview, I could find out what direction to go with.
He speaks English?
Yes, he does. Both he and Vivienne both speak English.
Or did you read any of Vivienne's books? Were you
no.
able to?
I'd actually read an article she wrote about the French Revolution that was in the Spring Journal.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I got in touch with her.
One of the things that has impressed me so much is that almost, I think, every Jungian analyst that I've spoken with over the radio has been so widely read.
Mm-hmm.
They read voraciously.
Mm.
They have knowledge in so many areas. Have you noticed that?
I've noticed that.
So they're really true intellects.
Yeah, they follow Jung that way. I think he was knowledgeable in so many different areas. So
right.
I think that's just part of, being really into Jungian psychology.
When I first asked you about who you might have sought out from all these giants in your interviews, that you might have looked to as a possible analyst had they been alive and, the right age when you were looking for an analyst,
mm-hmm.
which one, I think you mentioned Adolf Guggenwill Craig.
Yeah.
And why would you have wanted to work with him? What was it?
Well, Adolf is a very interesting man. He has an ability to look at things in a very different way than most of the culture would look at something. You have to kind of read Adolf to know what I'm talking about. But he just has a tremendous way of picking up, I would say, the shadow area of life in just a very interesting way. I thought it would be very interesting to work with another person. Robert lives in Australia now, and he has a very interesting way of connecting the psyche with the body. And that, I think, would have been very helpful to me. As I kind of work with both my psyche and my body.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be very helpful to me to have worked with him.
When you grew up yourself, did you live in a very, not a repressed home, but one that was very formal?
Well, I lived in a home. My father's family was from England.
Mm-hmm.
And about half of his family were born in England. So I would say half of my life has been very impacted by the kind of the English culture, and not necessarily the best part of that, but the kind of the stifling part of that. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily that helpful, even though my father was a wonderful man. I had a very mm-hmm. good relationship with my father. I just think that influence was not the most helpful to me.
Well, it also probably unwittingly helped you in all of your interviews. Being kind of a proper British guy,
yes.
People felt safe. I know John Beebe said that having an interview with you is like 6 months of psychoanalysis.
That's what he said.
Right. That's right. That was quite complimentary.
Yes.
He's such a wonderful man. He's very, very gentle and very kind and very extraordinarily intellectual, astute. What about Carl Jung's writing or research and teaching is the most prominent in your own work? You know, everything you've learned about Carl Jung.
Oh, boy, that's a big question.
That's a big one.
That's a big one. I love to read Jung. It's interesting, over the years, I wrote about this a little bit in the introduction in Volume 3. I think my whole notion of who Carl Jung is has evolved over my life. I think when I first met him, when I started my doctorate degree, I was at a place in my life. I had graduated from seminary, and I was kind of just filled with all kinds of things I learned in seminary. I was just sort of filled up with theology and all kinds of things about biblical criticism and various things like that. And I had really lost my passion for ministry. And I think at that point, when I encountered Jung for the first time, I think I sort of regained my soul and my passion. So in some ways, he was like a god to me back then. I mean, he was godlike. And I've met over the years a lot of people who still regard Jung as sort of a god, or other people regard him as the devil. I guess you can go both ways on it. I would say over the course of time, I would say that sense of Jung as a godlike sort of figure and all his writings being kind of sacred, as I got into my work as a psychotherapist, evolved into Jung became kind of a collaborator and a friend. And I could read various things that he had written of how he did therapy, how he did analysis, how he worked with dreams, and how he worked with relationships. And so he was like a friend in my work as a therapist. And as I've gotten older now, I just turned 65 in June, I think now in my life, Jung has become he's become someone who sort of helps me understand my life better. And I find myself drawn more of his letters and his artwork and more personal things. Certainly not a god to me anymore. I think he would have been someone that would have been just a wonderful person to be around, but I think he also would have been a very difficult person to be around. I don't think he was necessarily the easiest person to be around, but I think he'd been fun to be around. He was a type of person who wrote letters to people, probably in somewhat the way we write emails. I mean, he was just a prolific letter writer, and I just love to read the two volumes of letters that he wrote people, and I just feel kind of like he's like a dear friend.
Where are the two volumes of letters? Is that in a book called Two Volumes of Letters?
They're called The Letters of C.G. Jung. They're two big volumes.
Okay.
Those are just wonderful. Back at that time, Jung was the type of person that if Tyra was in California and wanted to write to Jung about a dream she had, she might sit down and write him a letter, and she would get a letter back. And so a lot of people around the world got letters from Jung. In fact, we're just discovering how many letters he actually wrote. Some people are saying now there are over 25,000 letters that he wrote.
My gracious.
Just amazing, amazing letter writer.
Do you do dream work?
I have, yes. I've done that quite a bit throughout my career. I lead dream seminars occasionally, but I work with people in their dreams. Yep.
Can I send you a dream?
Sure. You bet.
Maybe I'll send one to you and Dr. Beebe and Dr. Steven Eisenstadt and Dr. Marotti, a few people who work with dreams, and I'll get some insight.
Oh, well, that would be interesting.
That'd be interesting to write.
Get everybody's take on it. Yeah,
right. You're familiar with the Red Book that's coming out in October.
I am so excited. I can't wait. In fact, I did an interview that's going to be published pretty soon with the person who was one of the key editors, Sanu Shamdasani. And that's going to be coming out in the Spring Journal in the next issue.
Wow.
He was the one that they did a lot of the work on the Red Book. That's coming out in October, and I just can't wait. In fact, I've got plans to, they're actually bringing the Red Book over from Zurich to the Rubin Museum of Art in New York City.
Oh, really?
And I'm planning on going in just so I can see it.
When is that?
In October. I think it's like early October sometime. It's going to be at the Rubin Museum of Art from October till I think maybe the first part of next year.
Oh, I want to see that, too.
Yeah, I bet you would enjoy it. It's 95 years old, the book, and it's, you know, hardly anybody's ever seen it except very close members of the family.
I know. I've spoken with Dr. Martin. Is he a doctor? I think he is.
Stephen Martin, yeah, he's a doctor. Yep.
Several times. And actually, they are still looking for contributions because it's been a very costly project.
Exactly.
To put this Red Book on the market. And
exactly.
It is something that is going to go down in posterity as one of the greatest publication events of our time.
That's what everybody's saying.
I've got my order in for one of the early
editions. You really?
Oh,
good
yes.
For you.
I've had it for a long time. And I also have a lot of reading to do before I even get there.
Yeah, great.
You know, because I'm not anywhere near you and some of the analysts that I've spoken with. There's so well read in all of Jungian's work.
I'm sure you're going to enjoy that book. Some people are saying once that book comes out that Jung's going to be known by future generations more as an artist than a psychologist.
Well, he certainly was that, and that's one of the very interesting parts about Carl Jung.
Yes.
Those amazing designs that he made that were primarily, I guess, at least in one level, intended for meditation.
Yes, that's right.
And do you know anything about them that you can say?
I visited the Jung house about three times, visiting on two occasions with his son, Franz, and on the third occasion with his grandson, Andreas.
Mm-hmm.
The second time I visited Franz, he gave me these little notebooks that were his father's. They were called the Black Book. They were actually Jung's dream journals.
Oh, my gosh.
And apparently, if I understand it correctly, apparently what he would do would be to record a lot of his dreams in these Black Books. But then when he would have a big dream, he would paint it.
Oh.
That's what was in the Red Book, were the big dreams.
But it wasn't like, I'm trying to say, is it a mandala, a circular design necessarily?
Yeah, mandala.
It was still in a mandala form.
I think he tried to paint his dreams. I don't think they were all mandalas,
right.
But there were mandalas in the book. I think I haven't seen it, of course. But I think what's in the book are his dreams.
It's almost as if Carl Jung was sent by the divine forces of the universe.
You get that feeling sometimes, right? Yes.
To teach us about how to live.
Yes, that's right.
And we don't have to deny our negativity. We work with it and bring it into our personalities and tame it.
Exactly, and see the richness that's there. That's
the richness of the tapestry.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yes.
It's a very exciting concept as compared to feeling overtly or extra guilty your whole life about your vulnerabilities.
Yes.
Which most of us do, you know.
Yes, that's
have,
right.
Have vulnerabilities of some kind.
That's right.
Why many people go to the therapist in the first place.
Yes.
Or why they're having problems in marriage or whatever.
Yes.
It's very, very interesting. One of my goals in this series of the DNA of Carl Jung is to broaden the public understanding of Jungian psychology. I think the Red Book is certainly going to do that.
Oh, I think you're right on, Tyra. I'm glad you're mentioning that.
Right.
Yes.
And I think that, you know, it is so valuable to understand Carl Jung's teaching and writings. It's been dwarfed somewhat by Freud being here first, and he was also a very extremely valuable contributor and initiator of much of modern psychology.
Yes.
However, the traditional thought being such as it is, it can get a little bit stuck.
Mm-hmm.
And then when people are traditionalists, they don't want to look at the new. And most of what Carl Jung says is not necessarily only new, but it's different, and it's in the abstract, and it's in the dream state.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not easy to explain, and it's not easy to understand.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's that part of ourselves that is poetic and is in a dream and is a sense of things from a broader, deeper perspective.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. That's very nicely said.
Thank you so much. I'm glad that you have found him to be such a collaborator and friend in your life.
Thank you. I don't know what my life would be without him, I'll tell you the truth. He's been very, very important. Say, when I say that, I hope the listeners will understand I'm not painting him out to be a perfect person, because he certainly had his shadow as much as anybody else does and his difficulties. And I think that he tried to work with his difficulties in life as much as anybody else did. As all people with such a kind of a gigantic personality, as I say Jung had, I'm sure he was very, very difficult to live with, but I think he did the best he could, like everybody else tries to do. So he wasn't a perfect person, but he had a genius about him, and he also had his difficulties.
And he was also very, very honest.
Yeah, I think he was, yeah.
And I think that his being forthright with his own vulnerabilities, it was part of his intuitive personality and his ability to go in deeper and find out about himself in order to understand his patients.
Exactly.
And it was so, I think it was really humble in a different way to do that, because he was really dealing with some of the most profoundly troubled people in asylums at that time,
yes,
in mental hospitals, and people who were very, very sick with what we would call schizophrenia today, or some of the other illnesses that are difficult to not only heal but to understand.
Yes.
He was able to do that, but he did it by that humility, or whatever you want to call it, that would allow him to look at his own psyche.
Exactly. Yep. That's well said.
Yeah, and you, that's what you're doing. That's what I hope to do more and more of. And
good. And I hope you do.
And understanding dreams and all of that. I haven't been doing dream work very long.
Uh-huh.
And so that's a whole new
world. Yeah, that's look forward to.
It's a lot to do in the morning because, you know.
It is.
To try to write it down. And, you know, it's when you're thinking about 14 other things that you have to do before the end of the day.
You're exactly right. You're exactly right. Some people I've interviewed find they can only do it on weekends because they just have such busy lives. But I think you just do it whenever you can. You know, at least you're honoring that part of yourself that goes deeper and that, you know, that is in your own life in an unconscious way.
That's a good name of a book, my weekend dream book.
That's good.
Right. Well, you are so wonderful. I just appreciate your being on today.
Well, thank you, Tyra. I've enjoyed this very much, and I commend you for doing this series. I think it's a very valuable thing you're doing, and
thank you. Keep up
the good work.
Well, I would like to talk with you again to fill in that a part of a former interview
okay. That
we had we had some sound difficulty in the background.
Yeah,
and I'd like
okay.
to fill that in, so I'll be calling you about that.
Please keep in touch.
I certainly will, and my very best to Janice.
Thank you very much, and your listeners are very lucky to have you out there.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
You betcha.
Okay,
thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. This is Tyra St. John on Inside Out, the DNA of Carl Jung. You've been listening to Dr. Robert Henderson, who is the author of Living with Jung, Interviews with Jungian Analysts. Volumes 1 and 2, he and Janice Henderson have written these books, and there's a third volume about to come out in December. Stay tuned for Our Stories, Our Lives.
Somewhere deep in the jungle are living some little men. Women. They are our past, and maybe they are our future. Get it, 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 get it